Silas, bound in jail, had no money for to pay that bail. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on. Paul and Silas began to shout. The jail.
KBOO Portland.
Attention, KBOO volunteers. This is an all-hands-on-deck announcement. As of Friday, March 13th at 10 p.m., our station is closed to all volunteer activities. Only staff will be allowed in the building. If you're a program host, we need your help remotely. Even though we're closing the front door for 30 days to reduce the spread of infection, our airwaves still need you. Please pre-record your show and submit your audio to your director. If you have any questions or need assistance, please email staff. Information about KBOO's response to the COVID-19 pandemic is available on our website at kboo.fm/COVID-19. Thank you for helping to keep our airwaves up to date and engaging for our listeners who need your voice now more than ever. Together, we'll be able to get through this. Oh yeah, and don't forget to wash your hands.
Quarantined studio for KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the United States Senate has restarted talks on Monday over a massive $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill to shore up the economy. Talks broke down over the weekend after Senate Democrats balked at the disproportionate help in the Republicans' bill being offered to corporations over ordinary Americans and their households. In attempting to justify why much of the taxpayer-funded financial help goes to the top sectors of society, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin asserted, "This is not corporate welfare. This helps all American workers." The Washington Post explained that as it stands, the bill, quote, would direct $1,200 to most adults and $500 to most children. It would also create a $500 billion lending program for businesses, cities, and states, and another $350 billion to help small businesses meet payroll costs. The Post also offered up more detail on Democratic opposition, saying the party's, quote, concerns have focused on a $500 billion funding program for loans and loan guarantees Republicans want to create, which some Democrats are labeling a slush fund, because the Treasury Department would have broad discretion over who receives the money. There is little precedent for a program with a similar size and scope. The current piece of legislation being debated is the third funding bill that Congress is tackling, focused on the impact of the coronavirus. Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib has earned praise for offering an alternative proposal that would shore up the economy by focusing on people's needs. Her proposed plan includes distributing debit cards loaded with $2,000 to every American that would be recharged with $1,000 a month every month until a year after the end of the crisis. She notes that her plan would be deficit neutral despite the anticipated price tag because it, quote, would be funded directly from the Treasury using its legal authority to create money via coin seigniorage, which is a statutory delegation of Congress's constitutional power of the purse. Tlaib's idea has received praise from a number of economists and business reporters. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve on Monday unveiled new drastic measures to prevent the economy from teetering off of a cliff. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell announced 90 minutes before the start of trading on Monday that there would be no limit to purchases of Treasury and mortgage-backed securities this week. President Trump has continued to make the coronavirus crisis all about himself. He railed on Twitter that in his scouring of media coverage of the pandemic, quote, "All I see is hatred of me at any cost." On Friday, Trump made headlines for having a meltdown after a reporter asked him what he could tell Americans who were scared. Trump is also fearful of the economic collapse that the coronavirus could trigger, as reports point out that all economic gains made over the past several years have already been wiped out. The president appeared to suggest that a quarantine of only 15 days might be sufficient, as he retweeted a suggestion that read, 15 days, then we keep the high-risk groups protected as necessary, and the rest of us go back to work. He also tweeted in all caps, we cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. Trump's re-election campaign has centered on the health of the economy, not people. Trump's former home, New York City, is quickly being considered the epicenter of the U.S. outbreak of COVID-19, with 5% of all cases worldwide, not just the nation, being reported there. According to the New York Times, more than 15,000 people in New York State have tested positive, with a vast majority in the New York City region. That is about half of the cases in the United States. By Sunday, 114 people had died in the city. In the state of California, there are so far 1,800 cases of infections and 35 deaths. A Navy hospital ship based in San Diego has been deployed to Los Angeles in anticipation of more infections. Nationwide, there are now a reported 35,200 infections and 471 deaths. Although President Trump has said he called on the National Guard to be activated in New York, California, and Washington to provide resources to those states, governors and mayors across the U.S. are expressing frustration at the federal government's inaction, particularly over Trump's refusal to invoke the Defense Production Act. That decades-old law gives the president the authority to call on industries to mass-produce necessary equipment, which in the case of the coronavirus epidemic would mean personal protective equipment for frontline healthcare workers that is in short supply. Trump has said he would invoke the law, but has so far not done so. Several members of the U.S. Senate are under quarantine after Kentucky's Libertarian Republican Rand Paul became the first senator to test positive for COVID-19. Senator Paul, who was one of only 8 lawmakers to vote against a paid sick leave bill, reportedly, quote, went about his routine for days after being tested, potentially exposing many colleagues. Senators Mike Lee and Mitt Romney are now among those self-quarantining over potential exposure. When a reporter informed Trump that Romney was self-quarantining, the president said sarcastically, gee, that's too bad. Romney has been one of President Trump's few Republican critics. And the New York Times is reporting that scientists say that losing one's sense of smell may be a critical symptom of the coronavirus before other symptoms emerge. One expert said anyone who develops loss of sense of smell should self-isolate. In election news, former Vice President Joe Biden, who is the Democratic Party's presidential frontrunner, has struggled with visibility since his campaign was forced into the digital realm. Unlike his rival, Senator Bernie Sanders, who has held several successful online roundtables and fireside chats, and even raised $2 million for impacted communities, Biden has barely spoken publicly. The hashtag #WhereIsJoe has been trending on social media. In international news, a reported 1.5 billion of the world's population has been asked to quarantine itself in the face of the coronavirus. That's 1/5 of the world's population. Health workers have become the most impacted group. According to Associated Press, Spain reported more than 3,900 healthcare workers have become infected. British health workers are pleading for more gear, saying they felt like cannon fodder. In France, doctors scrounged masks from construction workers, factory floors, and architect. In China, where the virus first ravaged cities, things have begun to normalize. And Cuba, which constantly faces criticism in the Western media, has deployed a small army of its doctors and nurses to Italy, the nation with the highest death toll from the virus so far. The tiny island of Cuba has sent 5 other teams to battle the coronavirus in countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua. A major headline on Monday, unrelated to the coronavirus, was that California's embattled utilities company, PG&E, will be pleading guilty to involuntary manslaughter in the case over the devastating campfire that killed at least 85 people. And finally, U.S. State Secretary Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to Afghanistan on Monday to do damage control as an internal conflict within the Afghan government threatens to unravel a hard-won peace deal with the Taliban. Two men have declared themselves president in Afghanistan and are running parallel governments, incumbent Ashraf Ghani and vice president and former warlord Abdullah Abdullah. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Amid the calls for social distancing and quarantines around the U.S. and world, one population whose well-being seems to be falling at the bottom of the priority list is those who are in custody, in detention centers, in prisons and jails. On Monday in California, the first documented infection of a prisoner was announced. In New York City, jails have reported 38 infections of the coronavirus. Mayor Bill de Blasio has so far authorized the release of 4 dozen people from Rikers Island, but so far many worry the pace is too slow. Black and brown communities are disproportionately overrepresented in U.S. prisons and jails. My guest is Noelle Hanrahan. She's the director of Prison Radio. Welcome to the program, Noelle.
Thank you for having me.
So first, as far as you know, have the social distancing measures even been raised in prisons and jails around the country? I imagine that it's a huge patchwork depending upon which system, which part of which state we're talking about. But if there's a shortage of hand sanitizers in the general public, I can't imagine that the prison population or the jail population is having any access, right?
Prison Radio talks to prisoners every day. So we have 47 correspondents around the country. We're hearing from the few that we've talked to in the last few days that they are getting information over their closed circuit TVs and from their unit managers and from the Department of Corrections, but they're not getting access that's meaningful. It's impossible to have a situation where there is enough distance between prisoners because of the massive overcrowding, because the US Supreme Court has said that double celling is okay, and because of the nature of prisons. Also, in terms of what they have access to, they're getting some masks, but those masks are insufficient. The hand sanitizers, in, at least in Pennsylvania, I talked to an inmate this morning, are in a cupboard, and they don't have access to additional soap. It's very difficult to get hygiene products in normal times in prison because you have to pay for them at the commissary. So he's saying it's very difficult. We have a report that in Pennsylvania, for the 47,000 inmates who are held in this close, tight sections of prisons, there is one medical facility that has 4 ventilators.
Wow.
So they're going to be dealing with people who are at extreme risk. And we also have populations in these prisons who are older and have medical conditions. So it's a complete toxic, ripe firestorm that is about to happen. And like I was saying in our communications with our constituents, there are really no walls. There are really no barriers. The virus is not going to respect a prison wall. People come in and out. The guards come in and out. Who's vulnerable? The prison guards, the prisoners' communities, and the communities that the guards go back to. If this isn't dealt with efficiently and effectively and immediately, this is going to put the United States, every single state, every single facility that houses people in these conditions is going to suffer exponential epidemic. And they really need to look at it that way. Immediately, absolutely immediately. No trickling 2 dozen people released in New York. They need to release every single person in pretrial detention who is eligible for bail. If they can't make the bail, they have to release them, because they said that if they could make the bail, they were not a danger to the community. They have to release them immediately. Everyone, everyone who has a release date in 2020 and 2021, who's going to be released into the community very soon, they need to be released immediately. They have to get down to single celling, and they have to absolutely release those who are elderly with pre-existing conditions. So we are at great risk. We are also now at great risk with the guards and the guards' families. This is the one issue I have ever, ever really thought that I was going to totally agree with the Pennsylvania State Guards Association, and every single guards union in the country should be immediately calling for this, because our lives and their lives are at stake.
Now, of course, the United States has one of the largest prison populations in the world, which sets us apart because this is a global crisis. In recent weeks, we've heard about riots happening in prisons in Brazil, in Colombia. There was just news of a riot because prisoners are terrified that they're being forgotten, and they're, you know, while the rest of society is being quarantined and encouraged to distance themselves with one another, they're shoved into these close quarters. We could see riots here in the U.S., and who can blame inmates for rioting in such a situation, right?
The prisoners that I've spoken with now are the ones who are the leaders in different communities, and they are being responsible and clear. I haven't heard any panic. And we've dealt with these situations. Now, this isn't a scale that is going to be unheard of. Prisoners are dying in isolation inside prisons throughout the country all the time, and there are not riots. Mumia Abu-Jamal was for a year and a half in a infirmary, which was in isolation, and he watched elders die. So this is already taking place. There's a community of people inside. Every prison's a community. There are a community of hospice workers who are prisoners who are there. It's a caring, loving community. So I think that to say that their prisoners are going to riot is not exactly accurate here right now. But I do believe that our common humanity, the guards, the prisoners, and the communities in which the guards live, really make it extremely important that this action happens now, and that people, the light bulb goes on.
So you mentioned Pennsylvania. What about California, which has a huge prison population? I mentioned that on Monday, the first inmate in California prison systems was tested positive for coronavirus. Has the governor of California, have local mayors, city mayors, taken any steps to try to push for the release of people in state prisons as well as those in county jails?
I've seen local authorities. I've seen Alameda County. I've seen Los Angeles County. I've seen jail facilities and sheriffs take action. I've seen Gavin Newsom say he wants to take some action, but there's a level of action that needs to be taken that is much more dramatic than they're taking. Like, they're releasing a couple hundred. That's not going to cut it. It really has to be, what is the single cell number, or what are these groups of people that we can release, like vast groups of people, because the overcrowding, California is at 137% right now.
Wow.
I mean, crowding, and that's with double selling, that's probably triple selling. So people really need to understand that there wasn't a reason. When you've seen the movie 13th, when you've seen and you've read the new Jim Crow, many of your listeners understand that there have been a warehousing of hundreds of thousands of people that has been unethical, immoral, and illegal. There has been this creation of a carceral state. We have 2 million people in prison. 2 million people in prison. That is more than any other developed country on earth, any developed country on earth. Therefore, that has been immoral, illegal, and unnecessary. And we need to undo that right now because all of our lives are at stake. So yes, we knew it, we were calling for it. We all know it's true that anybody in there for a nonviolent crime needs to get out.
Right. And so that actually leads me to my next question, which is, are there some practical steps to immediately take to release nonviolent prisoners, which would leave enough room in existing prisons for those who might be convicted of violent felonies to socially distance and to be, you know, to prevent the spread of disease? Because, of course, the public would be leery of all prisoners being released.
The public shouldn't be leery of 80% of the prisoners being released. That has been a fiction created by our culture. But besides that, there are measures that can be taken. You know, when we see things happen that just happen, you notice them. So a judge in Philadelphia released a death row inmate on Saturday. Mm-hmm. He has a petition of innocence before the court. The DA has said he's very likely innocent. She released him to a hospital on Saturday because he had symptoms of COVID-19. There was no court adjudication. The door opened. The same was true for Herman Wallace in Louisiana when he was getting out. Literally from one day to the next, that cell door was unlocked and opened. There are ways. Governors can do it. State legislatures can do it. There are going to be people held accountable. And there are some very good articles now being put out about the list. It's a short list. The mayors, the governors, the judges on the state level, and the legislatures, and they need to act immediately because the epidemic that we may be able to control in the next 2 weeks, the United States, all of us may be able to work with to dampen down, is going to be dramatically impacted if these focus centers, these locus of infection, are allowed to be overrun. And there is no way they're going to stop them. Prisoners who I talk with every day, I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, are always deeply concerned about the sanitary conditions in prison. It's one of their deepest concerns, always. They always talk about it. That's the reason why we have a hepatitis C epidemic inside prisons. We have a 2% in the population, and we have a 20% epidemic of hep C in prisons. So there's a problem with sanitation in prisons. There's a problem with overcrowding. So we need to recognize this, recognize that there will not be a social cost when people are released, and just release them.
Noelle, the Trump administration seems to be taking the approach of putting the health of the economy over the health of the people. President Trump has been, you know, tweeting suggestively on Twitter that that workers be allowed to return to work after just a 15-day quarantine because the cure for the COVID-19 pandemic could be more destructive than the actual virus itself. And he's sort of, you know, there's a worry that he might be trying to take the approach that in early days British Prime Minister Boris Johnson seemed to be taking, the Dutch leadership has tried to take as well, these right-wing authoritarian leaders who are basically suggesting, you know, let this thing run its course and those who die will die, because of course it's those people who don't have access to health care, who already have compromised immune systems, who are in prisons, who are, you know, working class, people of color, all of those vulnerable members of society that include prison inmates, that society, the establishment in our society is already written off.
I think we're going to lose a lot of people. I do not think, you know, we don't hear from the government about reasonable expectations of the curve and what's going to happen. I think Trump is ill-equipped in this moment to intellectually understand what's happening and or to make a plan. So we are in a desperate situation where the people behind him very likely have some abilities, but you can't see them at the microphone. So I just think that at this moment, we have to build the world we want to live in, and we have to act locally. We have to act locally as much as possible. And in great part, that also deals with the prisons. We have to put pressure on people locally to do the right thing. I think there's a little bit of room there. There have been some minor victories, but given the scope, the scale of the pandemic, we need a much more robust response. And so I think we need to demand that that happens locally.
So tell me about what some of the advocacy groups or what also family members of those incarcerated have been doing. I cannot imagine the fear of someone whose loved one is in prison right now, thinking about the much more increased risk of their infection, given the conditions you were mentioning about how they are so unsanitary and also the lack of ability to do social distancing. I imagine family members are extremely worried. Are they, you know, are there protests? Are there, you know, in as much as they can be in these times?
I think that people are very much taking action. And they have, I've seen this amazing group develop in Pennsylvania. So right now, one of the targets is the Allegheny County Jail. And if you go to the Abolitionist Law Center and the Amistad Law Project, they will show you things that people are doing. In New Jersey yesterday, we had people driving. They did a drive-by group gathering to protest ICE detention. ICE detention is another thing that just should be immediately. That's a federal level decision that could be made immediately. Empty ICE. Give everybody a ticket. Out. You know, everyone should be released from ICE detention. So I think that that's needs to be done immediately. And I think people can be really active. And I think people's families. The reason why the criminal justice system is dramatically changing and called into question, more so now than ever, is because of people's families and because they are organized and they are effective. So anywhere you live, you can find your people and you can start making change because it's happening.
Even if you can't get out and do drive-by protests, if you will, there are, of course, the old-fashioned ways in which to make one's voice heard, and that's picking up the phone and calling governor's offices, mayor's offices, the federal government with regard to the ICE detention centers, which we covered on our program last week, and all of those other ways that are still available, not to mention social media actions as well, right?
Correct. So you can be effective in this moment, and you can join a community. It can be done, so you should.
What are prison, going back to what you were saying earlier about the issue of prison guards being at risk, I imagine prison guard unions might be extremely concerned as well. Are they speaking out?
I have not heard them speaking out, but they should, because the interest of the state is not for their health. They have always been cannon fodder for the carceral state. And so I think that their interests are aligned at this moment with prisoners. And I think that they need to act aggressively because they are at risk. A New York State investigator who works in the prisons has already died. Other people have been testing positive. A lot of prison guards have been testing positive. So we are in a situation where their health is at great risk, and their family's health and their community's health is at great risk, because they are coming in every single day to a place where the pandemic is going to explode.
And of course, this is a pandemic unlike so many others. It's an invisible killer. Of course, it's not a death sentence necessarily if you get it, but it's an invisible virus that can remain dormant before symptoms show up for up to 14 days, as per some reports, which is really shocking. So a whole prison population can be interacting with one another, spreading the disease around, and no one would know till the first symptoms started to arise. And that's terrifying. It could be happening right now. We mentioned how sanitary conditions of sanitization are, and just in general cleanliness is so poor within prisons because of lack of resources. But even the medical system there is poor, right? Doctors and nurses in the general population know they're going to have not enough masks, not enough equipment, not enough ventilators. In the healthcare systems within prisons is even far more overstretched and has fewer resources, right?
Yeah, there are 47,000 prisoners and there are 4 ventilators, and their access to medical care in the infirmary is very limited. So
I imagine testing is a similar situation. The U.S. public is not having easy access to testing unless you're rich and famous. If a prisoner is showing symptoms and asks for a coronavirus test, chances are they're not going to get one.
It seems very likely they are not going to get them.
So, Noelle, in terms of what you're seeing happening inside prisons, you mentioned that you've got correspondents around the country. What are inmates saying? I know that on Prison Radio, you've put up at least one commentary from an inmate who is talking about this. How can we amplify the voice of inmates right now and hear from them directly?
I think every single journalist has to make that happen. They have to talk to people in prison. So that has to be a requirement for doing the story about prisons, has to be that they talk to someone, because it's possible. Also, Pennsylvania just started having video interviews because they're not having in-person interviews. You can sign up for a video interview with a Pennsylvania inmate. We need to prioritize hearing from the people that this affects directly. That includes prisoners. So every journalist is not doing a good enough job unless they talk directly to prisoners. And I think that's imperative in terms of people who aren't journalists. They need to just communicate with prisoners. That's by email if they have it, by phone, writing. Just keep up the level of dialogue and communication. Reach out to prisoners because the virus isn't respecting the wall. So I think we need to absolutely have as much contact with our loved ones inside as possible and our correspondents.
And, you know, the Senate is currently debating this bill, this $2 trillion economic relief bill that would give potentially, and it looks increasingly likely, every American adult $1,200 and for every child $500. I don't know if they're including prisoners in that, do you?
I don't.
And it's very likely that they're not, given how our society has written off prisoners in general. And so in terms of, you know, if cities and states were to start releasing prisoners, we know that a pre-existing problem has been that when inmates are released, there are just not enough support structures for them to return to normal life. I imagine that they are likely to face unemployment. They're likely to face all of those same challenges that they would ordinarily face, except now there's an economy that's even more broken.
I think people have families and communities. They've developed levels of sustenance, whether inside, everyone that I know inside, and there might be that because they're incredibly gregarious, but like one of my clients who did the commentary, Dennis Solomakeithan, he has 8 brothers and sisters. So he has a really deep family that it would welcome him home. So I think that a lot of people have connections. It's just a matter of, we need to release them. And then we need to help them, you know, and we're all going to be devastated economically. This country is going through a vast reorganization economically. There have been so many people laid off. So we have to come together as communities, provide that support, and prioritize what's important and necessary, food, housing, and building of the communities.
Is prisonradio.com the best place where people can find out about the work that you do? And are there resources that they could help out with as you do your work and working with prisoners?
We have a great e-blast. And so they can get it by emailing info@prisonradio.org and going to our Facebook page and looking for it. So our website doesn't have our blog listed, but you can go to the website, just sign up, you'll get the e-blasts. Usually we send out very detailed lists with links. So we have 2 or 3 of these COVID-19 in prison e-blasts that really go into detail about what people can do and what people are doing. So we can send those resources out to people. And we have 5,500 people on our email list. And we keep trying to grow that so that people have the resources.
We'll post a link to that from our website later today. Noelle, thank you so much for the work you do and for joining us today.
All right. Good night.
My guest has been Noelle Hanrahan, director of Prison Radio. We've been discussing how inmate populations across the U.S. are deeply vulnerable to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From a quarantined studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. After Italy, Europe's hardest hit nation from the coronavirus pandemic is Spain. More than 2,000 people have died from COVID-19 so far, and more than 30,000 are infected. Healthcare workers in Spain are particularly hard hit, with nearly 4,000 infected. Soldiers deployed to sanitize nursing homes this week made a grim discovery of several seniors were abandoned and left to die in their beds. While the situations in Italy and Spain offer critical lessons for what is in store for the US, my next guest, joining us from Barcelona, says that while Spain has struggled, it is, quote, vastly more prepared than the U.S. Ben Ehrenreich is a journalist and writer whose most recent book, The Way to the Spring, is based on his reporting from the West Bank. His next book, Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time, will be published in July by Counterpoint Press. He joins me to discuss his article for The Nation, which is entitled, We're Struggling with the Coronavirus in Spain, but We're Vastly More Prepared than the U.S. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Hi, Sonali. It's good to be here.
So first, we'll get to why you're in Spain a little bit later, but what is the situation where you are at right now in Barcelona? Can you give me a summary of what you're seeing? I'm assuming that the quarantine is still in full force and that people are essentially staying at home?
Yeah, the quarantine is in force. It was put into effect, I believe it was on the 14th of March, and has for 15 days. Has since been extended another 15 days. So now we're looking at being on lockdown at least until April 11th. And that means no one can leave their homes unless it is to go to work, if they still have a job that is requiring them to go to work, to go out and buy groceries, to go to the doctor. And have I lost you?
Nope, I'm here. We're still here.
No, I'm afraid I've lost you.
Uh-oh, we're still here. Hi,
hello.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're still here.
I can hear you.
Okay, just jump in.
So we're still on lockdown, which means you can go out only to go to the doctor, to go out and get groceries, to go to work if you still have work to go to walk your dog if you're lucky enough to have a dog, and to care for people, for dependents. But that leaves most people, since a lot of people, you know, most stores have, most shops, non-essential businesses have closed. Most people are hunkering down and staying indoors. I don't think I've left the apartment except to take the trash out or go up on the roof since it's now been almost a week. And we're looking at a few more weeks of this. So I can't tell you, there's not a lot that I can tell you that I saw with my own eyes, because I'm mainly seeing all what's going on in the apartment and on the street right outside. It's very quiet here. There's far less traffic than there normally is. The air quality is quite extraordinarily clean. you know, we do know there's a sort of spooky feeling of knowing that as quiet as things are in the hospitals and in medical centers, there are scenes of chaos and tragedy developing.
So let's talk about the healthcare system in Spain, which is an important point of comparison with the U.S. One of the big headlines that we've seen coming out of Spain around the pandemic is that the government, which is actually calls itself a socialist government, has nationalized the private hospitals in Spain. Still, we're seeing thousands of health workers infected, and you know, that just might be because of the scale of the crisis.
Spain has a quite robust public healthcare system. There are private hospitals. I've never quite understood why people use them, because the public healthcare system is very good and it's paid for out of your social security payments, out of your taxes. So it's you know, as an American, it's a quite extraordinary thing to go to the doctor here, and when you're done with the visit and you get good care, when you're done with the visit, nobody presents you with a bill. You know, there are neighborhood healthcare clinics in every community. It's a quite good system, despite, you know, the serious cuts since the last economic crisis. It's held up quite well, and I think is doing everything that can be done in this crisis. And we're seeing some rather extraordinary things, like, as you mentioned, the government has decided to take over the private hospitals and private healthcare facilities, which is something that would be, you know, unimaginable in the United States, where we, you know, what public health system there has been, you know, savagely attacked by cuts over the years, and most people have no access to it whatsoever. But here, you know, one thing I think that makes an enormous difference here is that in the U.S., people are afraid to go to the doctor. People are, you know. I think all listeners will know this. You know, before you call an ambulance, you think twice. Before you go to the doctor, you think twice. Will I be able to afford this? And that's not the case here. If you feel sick, you don't think twice about going to the doctor because of bills.
So the government of Spain, how has it been handling the situation? Last year, the Socialist Workers Party won elections, although the far-right party also made gains. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has seen some severe impacts, including, you know, people in his own cabinet being infected. And I understand that the Socialist Workers Party might be more socialist in name than in actual practice, but how has this government dealt with the crisis?
Sanchez's wife even has tested positive.
Right.
I think overall they've dealt with it quite well. You know, there's been a tension in this government from the beginning. They had to redo the election because Sanchez did not want to share power with Podemos, which is the left-wing party. After a second election, he was forced to share power with them. Podemos has been pushing for stronger measures, for stronger protection. So, for instance, Sanchez's government has already agreed a freeze on mortgage payments for those who are affected by the crisis, and a freeze on evictions related to people who can't pay their mortgages. And Podemos, for instance, has been pushing to extend that to renters. Podemos has been pushing as well for not just assistance to people who lose their jobs through this or lose work through this, for the many people who are self-employed, but for a national income, a universal national income, which is something they've been asking for quite some time. So that, you know, there's this tension with the left pushing harder for more measures, and some elements of Sanchez's cabinet, particularly his economic affairs minister, pushing back to try to prevent any real restructuring of the economy or the way things work here. But overall, certainly compared to the United States, I think the measures they've taken have been fairly extraordinary, and there is you know, some reason to be confident that the government is doing everything that it knows how to do,
and is not putting public profit, private profit before public health.
I understand that the private businesses, as you write about in your piece in The Nation, that the government has basically made private businesses that are capable of producing the kinds of goods needed in the needed to combat the virus, such as the personal protective equipment healthcare workers need, has pushed them into producing those here in the United States. We're still waiting for Trump to use the powers that he already has under the Defense Production Act. At the same time as hospitals are desperate for basic things like masks and gowns and gloves for nurses and doctors. So in Spain, it sounds like they had no such hesitation.
Yeah, exactly. Like two of the first measures that were taken were, as you mentioned, folding the private healthcare system into the public healthcare system and demanding that all individuals and companies either were sitting on big stockpiles of resources that would be helpful or were capable of producing them immediately report to the government. In the US, if you're on social media much, you're seeing stories about people sitting on giant stashes of Purell and trying to sell Purell or face masks at exorbitant prices over the internet. And the first thing that the government did here was try to make sure that couldn't happen, that all resources would be put at the behalf of the entire public. This is worlds away from the American response, in which private profit and particularly corporate profit will not be interfered with at all by this government.
And yet, in spite of this preparation, in spite of these aggressive measures, Spain is seeing a huge spike in cases. Like Italy, it is struggling. It's not as far, the situation isn't as bad yet as in Italy. You know, I imagine that a pro-capitalist in the United States, someone who is a, neoliberal capitalist, might look at that and say, look, Spain's socialist approach doesn't work. But another view could be that even with a strong government response, Spain is struggling, which means that in the U.S. we might be in for far worse. What do you think?
Yeah, that's my fear, that, the U.S., the virus came more slowly to the U.S., and of course the U.S. has been far, far, far slower to react. In many parts of the country, there are really no serious social distancing measures being put in place. Of course, there's no real public health care response. There's no federal response whatsoever. And my fear is that this means that things are going to get really, really out of control in the U.S. It's a matter of weeks before that begins to happen. We see that. And, obviously most of the people that I care about the most are in the United States, and I really hope that's not the case, but that is my fear.
Like many other European nations, Spanish society is extremely social, and there is, a lot of interaction. How has Spanish society changed? Was there reluctance or resistance to self-quarantining? Did the government have to issue direct orders or simply, have aggressive public service announcements?
They are definitely, there's police out there who are stopping people and fining people. Some of this is kind of comical. There was an article running around the papers of the police complaining of people walking goats and saying you're not allowed to walk your goat. It has to be a dog. I think they've issued several thousand citations. They're issuing fines of between 100 and, I think, something insane, like 60,000 euros, quite high fines. The government has had to make repeated statements telling people who live in cities not to visit their second homes in the countryside, not to try to get out of the cities and spread the disease to rural parts of the country. There have been some of this is frankly worrisome. In Madrid, they've been using drones to find people who are breaking the quarantine in public parks and plazas. Spain is a country with far more, I think, economic equality than the United States, but where racism runs pretty deep. The one instance I've seen out my window of the police stopping somebody was four cops stopping a young African man, and
searching him and holding him for a while before they let him go. You know, I see white Spanish joggers going past my window every day. You're not supposed to be jogging, but nobody seems to stop them. So, you know, the fear here, as it would be in the U.S. or any other part of Europe, is that when you have these kind of increased police powers, it comes with a greater risk to minorities and to people who are already vulnerable.
So the you mentioned earlier that there was a there was action being taken on, you know, people's mortgage payments, et cetera, being frozen. Here in the U.S., the Senate is struggling to reach some kind of an economic deal to provide relief for workers. But of course, there's corporate handouts tucked in. What sort of legislation has the Spanish government passed to ensure that ordinary people are taken care of, or because Spain has much stronger social safety net that, you know, is pre-existing, maybe they haven't had to resort to things like that, you know, $1,000 or $1,200 per person, you know, of cash.
They've had to do some. I mean, with the original emergency order, which Sanchez pushed through Congress, and which he was able to get support for from even from the conservative parties. And which has just been extended. There are provisions in it to extend Social Security protections, to extend, really to expand and extend the existing social safety nets, to give them additional funding. But yeah, in Spain, even as a freelancer, you have the possibility of financial assistance if you're out of work. And now there's going to be a lot of people, both freelancers and non-freelancers, who are out of work and really having a hard time. So Spain is doing everything it can, as far as I understand, to extend protection to people who are affected by this, meaning actual cash payments, preventing evictions, things like that. So far, only for homeowners, not for renters. You know, there has been this dynamic that I mentioned earlier with the left pushing harder, but Sanchez has certainly been pushing hard. He's been pushing the EU powers that be to make it possible, to lift the kind of austerity measures that prevented, in the last crisis, countries like Spain and Greece and the poor countries in Southern Europe from spending a lot of money to keep their population out of poverty.
So, Ben, you're an American journalist. How did you end up in Spain? I imagine you've been impacted by the travel ban, the temporary travel ban from Europe that Trump put in place.
You know, I'm not actually sure if I am, because I suppose technically American citizen residents are allowed to return. I think it's quite difficult to get flights now, and flights there are quite expensive. I came here, I mean, quite simply, my partner found a job here a few years ago, and I moved here to be with her about a year and a half ago. I mean, that's certainly one of the things that's most alarming to me is as we see national borders closing all over the world, to what degree mobility will again be possible and what kind of restrictions are going to be placed on in the future. This happens at a time when certainly Trump and right-wing governments around the world, and certainly the EU, even the ostensibly center-left governments within Europe, have been hardening their borders and trying to prevent certain people from crossing them. And now this thing happens where almost everybody is prevented from crossing borders. And so I certainly worry about what the world will look like when this ends. And for those of us who believe in mobility as a right of all peoples, this is deeply troubling.
And so do you fear that in not just Spain, but Europe at large, the crisis of the coronavirus pandemic is just going to be more fodder for the xenophobic forces that have cracked down against refugees? Europe has been the focus of a very serious refugee crisis, the biggest refugee crisis in modern history, coming, you know, from with refugees coming from Syria and Afghanistan and all of those war-torn nations that European and U.S. nations have been complicit in, and now so many nations in Europe refusing to take in refugees. Will the coronavirus epidemic, you fear, be a greater excuse, or you know, be used as greater justification for keeping refugees out?
Yeah, I mean, so far, to my knowledge, we're not hearing that kind of rhetoric in the U.S. I'm sorry, in Europe. We've certainly heard it from Trump in the U.S. as he, you know, tries to refer to the virus as a foreign virus and rather insanely implies that it's coming through the Mexican border. In the EU that I know of, nobody's been using that kind of rhetoric, or at least not in not you know, mainstream politicians. But it's something to be worried about. I spent a few weeks this summer on one of the NGO boats in the Mediterranean that's out there, you know, looking for refugees who would otherwise be in danger of drowning, and saw firsthand the incredible violence and hypocrisy that even the center-left governments of the EU are engaged in, you know, that's killing thousands and thousands of people because they don't want certainly Africans and people from the Middle East and South Asia to be coming into Europe. And I think we need to keep our eyes very, very closely on this as this crisis develops.
Finally, Ben, what advice would you give those here in the United States, particularly on the left, in terms of the pressure that needs to be applied on the government in the U.S. to do more? Spain and other European nations are further along in dealing with the pandemic than we are here. And, you know, we can only imagine what's in store for a nation of 350 million plus people with a narcissistic tyrant at the head of it and, you know, lawmakers that seem still more intent on rewarding corporations over the rest of us. Any words of advice that you could give?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that this makes clear is that whatever kind of physical social distancing people may have to do, solidarity is the only thing that's going to get people through this. And that's something that is deeply needed in the U.S., and it's something that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party alike, I think, have spent decades trying to destroy when it means anything other than corporate solidarity, the solidarity between billionaires. But when it means working people standing together and poor people standing together in order to ensure that they have a future, our government has always struggle to fight that. And that's precisely what we need. I think this virus is revealing all of the weakest links in American society, you know, from everything from the lack of sick leave to the absolute precarity with which most people live in terms of housing costs and medical costs. And because of, for those reasons alone, I think this virus may hit the U.S. much harder than it does nations with stronger social safety nets. And I think this is a moment to push extremely hard for workers' rights and for all of those issues that I think, you know, that I think have come to the front in the last year or two, regardless, in American politics. And this is not a moment to back away from them.
And it's just kind of tragic that there are so many, tragic but also heartening, that there are so many communities here in the U.S. who, in the absence of government support, are organizing themselves collectively as much as possible. Incredible stories of, you know, people helping one another in their community in organized ways, ensuring supplies get to them. But this is something the government should be taking care of, you know, with our tax dollars. People are stepping into the vacuum, but it shouldn't have to be that way. Ben, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you. We'll post a link to your Nation magazine article from our website so people